Reel number one. when you first went to Heddon Racecourse, what was it like there? How was it organised for being a military training centre?
The hutments had been built.
Yeah, describe as much of it as you can remember.
Huts, which there was 30 men to each hut, 15 either side. Part of the original buildings, which had been used as a racecourse, they were put into use, you see, for storage purposes, and on the grandstand some of the office part was being used as officers' quarters up top there. They were very comfortable, I've no doubt. Oh, we were all right with stoves and things in the room, so nothing to worry about in the huts.
So part of the racecourse had actually been, part of the racecourse buildings had actually been used by the military?
Yes, and the racecourse was derelict, of course. There'd been no racing there for years.
Hmm. What about the racing stables? Were they used by
we used them. We Signals had our horses in there.
Yeah.
Just the light horses. There was 12 freestandings and a loose box at each end. So that we could accommodate 14 or 15 horses there. There was one or two lean-tos outside, back of the brickwork, so we'd one or two horses in there. But we'd I think, about 15 horses altogether.
Yeah. Mm. But let's talk a bit about the battery. About its size and the units that made it up and what the function of each unit was. Start off telling me, first of all, about the size of the battery.
We had four 4.7 guns, ex the Boer War. It was actually, it was a naval gun which had been put on a land carriage for the part of the some siege, I believe. Sir Percy Scott was the man who did it. And the gun, as it was designed, had 14 inches recoil, which, while it was sufficient on a ship where it was on a fixed mounting, on a carriage it was not. And when they were used in France, we didn't have them, but some of the territorial batters took them out. This gun jumped backwards, and they had to have a post in front with a length of rope, what they call a spring, to keep it in position. Mm-hmm. But they were terrible guns to work. You know, the 60-pounder, which we got to take into France, they had a long trail behind with a spade on the end of it, and the gun recoil was 56 inches, which of course absorbed the shock. Maximum was 60, but normal recoil was 56 inches. You had two big chambers with springs in, which pushed it back again, and in the centre there was the recoil chamber, which had oil in it, a long cylinder, and the piston had a notch in one side, and there was a gradually increasing ridge inside the cylinder, so that the aperture through which the oil passed from one side to the other became less and less, and the resistance increased, you see. But of course that was merely to check the recoil, like a shot, like a modern shock absorber on a car. The springs had to push it back again.
I see.
But of course, as this gun barrel weighed 4,200 weights, you've got to have some fairly powerful springs, and do it in on long slides, which are kept greased, of course.
And there were four of these in the battery.
Four 4.7 in the battery.
Yeah. Tell me about each gun and its crew. You know, what the members were and what jobs they did.
There was a sergeant in charge. He was regarded as number one. He was generally called number one, you see. There was the limber gunner, who opened and closed the breech when you were in action. And in normal times, he serviced the gun. You know, was in charge of cleaning it and all that sort of thing. Then there was the gun layer, who, of course, he aimed the gun every time. And then the rest were ammunition numbers.
How many ammunition numbers would they be?
There's supposed to be a total of 8 in the crew. But, of course, that was in theory, because very often we didn't have sufficient people on hand.
So there'd be about 4 of these ammunition men?
4 or 5, yes, there should be. Mm.
I see. Mm. And apart from the gun crews, there were a lot of horses in the battery, weren't there?
No mechanical, all horses.
Yeah. How were the horses allocated per gun? And
eight horses to each gun team. Mm-hmm. 4 horses to each wagon team. The water cart had 2 horses. Then, of course, you had to have so many spares. Then there was the ammunition column. They had about 60 horses for all the limbers and wagons, you see. Each gun had 3 limbers. Firing limber, and then the first and second line.
What's a limber?
Well, that's an articulated vehicle. The rear port just has a pole to attach it to a hook on the front part, you see. And each one carried so many rounds of ammunition, you see, to into action. But we never used them in action, very rarely. Mm. But we used to carry in France what they called the echelon of ammunition.
Hey, Now, when the gun was going to get underway, how would the gun crew organise things to actually move the gun? What would be the features of the operation?
Well, you just harness the horses in, you see, and then when all was ready, you get the order to walk, march, the word walk. The each driver would put his whip on the off horse's neck, you see, just that's a sort of a signal to it. And then when he got the word to march, I just, you know, give it a nip and that, and they're all pulled together, you see. If you get eight horses all pulling as one, they can move it. And that was one thing we had to do. Apart from training the men, you had to train the horses. The first time we yoked up in those 4.7, which only weighed 5.5 tons, you had 8 heavy drafts in it. But the guns had been stood some time, and they were maybe, you know, a couple of inches or more into the ground. They broke the traces twice. And it was a long time before I could get the horses all to pull as one.
I see.
If any difficulty, we had drag ropes, which you would hitch onto the linchpins, on the, like sort of drag washer, on the side of the, on each wheel, you know, on the gun, not on the limber. And you could, these drag ropes would take the strain. If you're putting, say, 60 men on one side, you've got a gun in a hole, you'd double bank the first one, double rope, otherwise you could break it. Because 60 men, or whatever you had, say 30, you'd get the order, sort of together, and you went up like that, you said, together, heave. And all the men would heave just as one. And it used to be an accepted thing that under those conditions, 5 men were equal to a horse, because they could put such a concerted pull into it, you see. And very often when you got a gun stuck in a hole with horses, you couldn't get them all to pull absolutely dead in as one, you see. Maybe 2 or 3, one after another, but you could get all the men at the signal for the NCO, the sergeant, would be like that, walk, march. Well, of course, as he dropped his hand, the horses were all spurred and the men all pulled, and out that gun would come.
Good.
No bother.
Good. Okay, that deals with the gun and the gun crew. Let's talk about some of the other parts that made up the battery. Now, you've told me there were ammunition wagons.
Ammunition.
How many were there, and what type were they?
These limbers. There were 3 limbers to each gun. That was 12 limbers for the 4 guns. Then in addition...
A limber would be a horse-drawn carriage.
Yes, yes, yes. You had 4 horses for that. And then the rest of the ammunition was carrying GS wagons, general service wagons. Tear 1,500 weights, 2 or 3 quarters a rule, to carry 1,300 weights on the side of the wagon. Mm-hmm. And you had 4 heavy horses to pull a total weight of 2.25 tons. And I've seen them stuck many a time with that. Whereas in the town, one horse could pull it easily without any bother.
Good. Now, there were other people within the battery who were specialists at various jobs, like the farriers, for example.
Yes.
What sort of numbers did they make up, and what were their equipment?
With 3 farriers, and they had an anvil apiece, of course, with boxes and boxes of horseshoes, plus the portable forges and the various hammers and tools for shoeing the horse, you see, for paring the hooves, knives and all that sort of thing, because a horse wanted shoeing normally once a month. They wear his shoes out in 4 weeks on a road, not on the grass, but on a road, they wear the shoes out in about 4 weeks. So you would press shoes on. Pardon?
Go on.
You prise the old shoe off, you see, and then you pair it level. You have the new shoe is heated in the forge, and then he has the foot between his legs. Like, he just presses the new shoe onto the hoof so as to make its own bed. It just smokes and stinks for a few seconds. The horse doesn't feel it, you see. Well, then when that's done, it's plunged in water, and then it's put in position again, and the nails are driven through so that they come out at the side of the hoof, and then they're all turned over and cut off. So that the nail is, they're very soft nails with a wedge-shaped, square-topped head, and the shoe has holes fitted to fit those like that. You see, it's like a sort of a sunken rivet, like a countersink. It is.
Did the farriers have any other jobs apart from shoeing horses?
No.
What about the sort of general care of the horses if they were ill? And did you have?
No, we had An outside vet used to come in for that in England.
I see.
And but otherwise, the captain or the drivers themselves, if a horse was not fit for service, it went out. You see, you didn't mess about doctoring horses. You simply got a remount. You see, from the remount depot.
Yeah. Now you had saddlers as well. What was their job?
Mostly repairing nose bags, because the wear on nose bags was terrific. You see, a horse, when he's feeding with a nose bag, if the strap is over his head, it's too long, he can't reach it, so he puts it on the ground and he rubs it like that, get every bit out, and he's rubbing the bottom of the nose bag on the ground all the time. Wear him out in no time.
Mm. And is that all the saddlers do?
They had to repair harness as well, you see, but the wear and tear on harness was nothing near as much as the repair on the nose bags.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was the wheelwrights.
Yeah.
Billy Newlove was the chief man there, I remember his name. Little squat fella with a sort of beaky nose and very fair hair.
And what was their responsibility?
All the wooden part of the vehicles.
Yeah.
The wheels we had on those guns to start with were wooden wheels with an iron tyre on, you see, and the first 60-pounders we got, they had a wooden wheel, and then a second wooden wheel was bolted right through the fellow. And it was about an inch less diameter, so that normally you run on a 6-inch wheel on hard ground, but as soon as you got on soft ground and it began to bed in, the width of the wheel was doubled.
Mm-hmm.
And those were very good wheels, much better than the later ones. We got the steel tractor wheels with diagonal bars on. Well, they ran very badly. The drivers used to say that they took twice as much pulling as the wooden wheel with a continuous round tyre, see, smooth tyre.
Yeah. Now, there were water carriers as well. What was their job, and what equipment did they use?
They just had a cart. It was a cylindrical tank, 110 gallons capacity, mounted on the wheels, that's all. And the pipe came out from underneath, spread into a bar, and there were four taps on that, so that they could fill the dixies, you see.
Hmm.
You wanted rid of your water as fast as you could when you got up the battery. You didn't want to waste time, so they could fill four dixies at once. And then we used to store the water, the dixies with the cover on, you see, the cooking dixies, they were oval things, you know, about, I say, 2 or 3 gallons capacity, like that. And then, in addition, we used to use cartridge boxes. They were metal lined, of course. We used to fill those. They held about 10 gallons of water.
Were the water carriers carrying water for the horses as well as for the men?
No. We didn't have any horses up at the battery.
Uh-huh, I see.
They were all behind.
Yes.
They delivered the ammunition, whatever it was, by night when they came up. They go straight back in, you see. Mm. The wagon lines were always near a plentiful supply of water. Mostly, in my experience, we were generally in or near somewhere near the River Somme.
Now, apart from the water carriers, there were signallers, and you were one of those.
That's right.
What was the size of the signal unit with the battery, and what sort of?
At first, there was in the first battery, there was about 15 of us starting. We got a few more later on. We went down to Paul in early 1915. It was Easter week, the week before Easter. And we had a sergeant from the Army Ordnance Corps to take us on gun laying as well. And we went to Sunk Island with 2 6-inch guns and a Baron Stroud rangefinder mounted on three towers, you see.
Yeah. Just tell me, how many signallers were there with the battery?
Well, with a 6-gun battery, there was 31.
31 signallers.
3 NCOs and 28 men.
Yeah. And the basic the basic task of the signallers was to provide information for the people who actually fired the guns.
That's right. Yeah. Communication from brigade headquarters behind up to the battery, and then from the battery forward to the observation point, which wherever it was, to the OP exchange, because as a rule, apart you had a direct line to your own battery, then you had what they called the OP exchange, which is between the batteries and the front line, you see. So that all OPs, if necessary, could get through. If their own line was this, they could get through via the OP exchange, you see.
Okay, we'll go into a bit more detail about signalling in a minute. Of course, there were some officers with the battery. Were they specialists? Did they have special jobs, or were they just for general disciplinary purposes?
No, as a rule, they were gunnery officers, you see. The one officer who was not with the battery was the captain. He stayed at the wagon lines, always, I'm now talking of when we were in France, you see. He's in charge of transport. The major is in charge of the battery as a whole, you see. And he's on gunnery, you see. He relies on the captain for the transport. Well, then you had a first lieutenant who was sort of a spare man, shall we say. Then each second lieutenant had two guns, a section, as that was termed, right, centre and left sections on the six-gun battery. So you had three second lieutenants.
That would be with a six-gun battery.
Yes, with a six-gun battery.
This was a four-gun battery.
You only had two, then, you see. And then the signal officer was, as a rule, as an officer who was regarded as not being good enough to go under guns because under active service, you've got experienced NCOs with the signalers, and the sort of understanding was that they would see things all right. And in my experience, you get a new signal officer, you know, who's this bloke, etc. And after a bit, he'd say, well, what's the programme today, Corporal? And you'd tell him what you're going to do. Very well, carry on. That was it. In other words, he asked you what he had to tell you to do.
Good.
You never had an officer who was specialised on signals.
You didn't?
No.
No, I see. Now, the whole battery amounted to about 200 men, you said?
A four-gun battery, yes, yeah. 200 men and five officers. Yes. A six-gun battery, 300 men and seven officers.
Was there much feeling of the battery being a team and working as a team?
Oh, yes, the sections were. You had rivalry between the sections, of course, especially on the football field.
Yeah.
I mean, this battery, we had four football teams, A, B, C and D, ammunition column and reserves, you see. Each of and then the signallers. Strange enough, we signallers were only 15 men. We were, well, there was only D sub could touch us.